Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the
Welcome to the Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University, and I'm joined by Ken Katkin, a professor of law at Chase Law School in Northern Kentucky. Welcome back to the Politics Guys, Ken.
Thanks, Trey.
Well, it's always a lot of fun to be doing the show, and I know we've got a lot of new voices, but this week you get myself and Ken on, I think, one of the bigger policy weeks that we've had in a while. I know a lot of times when we're doing the show, I think politics sometimes trumps policy here, not because that's not what we want to do, but it ends up being what the big news of the week is. But I think this week there's a lot of policy things to be said. With Robert Mueller's statement, and really it's a really brief statement. His major points were that he's resigning from the Justice Department, he's closing the special counsel office, and he just wants to, quote, make a few remarks, because in general he wants, quote, the work to speak for itself. And so what is that he's trying to communicate? Well, one, and I think this is something that we're going to be talking about here, Ken, is that, quote, if we had confidence that the president clearly did not commit crimes, we would have said that. We did not. However, make a determination as to whether the president did commit a crime, a president cannot be charged with a federal crime while he is in office. That is unconstitutional. And he goes on to say that he doesn't believe it's appropriate for him to speak about this investigation, even to Congress. So, Ken, one of the things I want to kind of ask you, and we've had some listeners talk about, is this really unconstitutional, or is it in fact just a policy of the DOJ? And what do you take on this statement? I'll start you there.
Yeah, actually, I have to parse the words of his statement carefully, because I'm not sure that Robert Mueller purported to say that he thought it was unconstitutional. I think what he purported to say is that the Justice Department Office of Legal Counsel, since the mid-70s, has had a policy that says that it would be unconstitutional to indict a sitting president. I think that policy actually got started in connection with when they did indict Spiro Agnew, who was the sitting vice president. There was they wrote a policy paper about why it's okay to indict a vice president, but it wouldn't be constitutional to indict a president. And that's been the policy ever since. So I think he was only saying that the Justice Department policy is that it's unconstitutional to indict a sitting president, and that he was going to adhere to Justice Department policy. So I don't know that he weighed in on whether he agreed with the merits of that policy or the substance of that policy, or even whether he considered it, because he may have just considered that he was going to follow policy without even thinking harder about whether he agrees with it or not. But I don't think it's obviously a correct constitutional analysis, if that was part of the question. Court has ever weighed in on it. Yeah, but I don't think the biggest inference is, I guess the arguments that are in the Justice Department white paper for why they say that a sitting president can't be indicted, there comes down to one piece of the Constitution's text and one structural inference. So the Constitution's text says that after impeachment, a removed officer, including a removed president, can still be indicted, tried, and convicted, right? So since it says being removed from office, essentially it wouldn't be double jeopardy to then criminally try somebody after they've already been impeached and removed, that someone can be impeached and someone can be indicted after they've been impeached and removed. There's possibly a negative inference there that means they can't be indicted before they've been impeached and removed, although it doesn't literally say that. And then the other structural inference is the idea that the president, unique among all federal officers, is someone who essentially has all the executive power vested in him by the Constitution, so that he can't, nobody else can really do the work of the president. So if he had to go to prison while he was president or something like that, then we wouldn't have a head of the executive branch. And so the idea would be that he's got to, he's got to first not be president anymore before that can happen. So that's kind of a structural inference. And that's part of in the Agnew analysis, why the Justice Department said it's perfectly OK to indict, convict and send to prison a sitting vice president, whether or not he's been impeached and removed, because he doesn't have any particular duties. He doesn't have all the executive power vested in him. Other people could do whatever work he's doing. And the same has certainly been applied in cases involving federal judges. There have been federal judges who've been indicted and convicted of crimes before they've been impeached and removed. In fact, one of them, Alcee Hastings, who's currently a member of Congress, was indicted, tried, and acquitted, and then impeached. So the indictment and trial came first, and he was acquitted by a jury. But then he was actually impeached afterwards for the same offenses. So for offices other than the president, it's been accepted that they can be indicted and tried first, and that's the reasoning, I guess, for why they think it's different for the president. I guess I'm just not sure that's crystal clear. I don't think it's a crazy theory, but I think there could be contrary theories. The framers did give us the impeachment process, so certainly the idea that the president can be held accountable during his term in office, that he's not above the law, that he may have to face some investigations and some penalties for crimes. You know, I think all of that is inherent in the idea that we have an impeachment process. If they really didn't want the president to be investigated or to be accountable or to possibly have to face charges while he's in office, then we wouldn't have impeachment at all. And I think the framers were very attached to the idea that we have a government under the rule of law, a government of laws, not of men. And there is something monarchical about the idea that the president, the king can do no wrong, and applying mm-hmm. that kind of thing to the president. So I think there's some countervailing reasons to think a president can be indicted. But, you know, at this point, it's all in the realm of theory, because no court has ever weighed in on any of this. No president's ever been indicted.
Right. And so this now brings us to this week's kind of shift, because last week, talking about impeachment, at least among Democratic candidates, in the words of NPR, and I think they had the spot on, was tepid. And now, post the comments, it seems like this is becoming an idea that has gained traction. On the pragmatic side of the policy here, do you think that the comments here, that if they had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, do you think that changes anything about the optics or the possibility of impeaching President Trump?
Yeah, I mean, you and I talked about that issue a month ago.
That's right.
Yeah, when the report was out but yet Mueller hadn't spoke publicly yet. And at the time, as you'll recall, and as some listeners will probably recall, you know, what I had said was that Barr got out ahead of things by knowing that most people aren't going to read a 400-page report, and by frankly mischaracterizing what the report said. And it's obvious that Mueller thought that Barr mischaracterized what the report said. There was the correspondence between them, which was reported a couple weeks ago, and then there was, you know, what Mueller said yesterday. I think it has been crystal clear the whole time on the substance that Mueller thinks that there's probable cause to believe that the president obstructed justice. That's what the Mueller report says. That's essentially what the quote that you just quoted says. Mm-hmm. And Barr had said the opposite, and a lot of the media, and a lot of public opinion was initially influenced by Barr's characterization. So, I don't know. The politics change, I think, only in a limited way. I don't think any significant number or even any Republican senators are prepared to vote to remove Trump from office. And so, just like a month ago, just like before Mueller had the oral statement, actual impeachment trial would be doomed to lead to an acquittal. And so that sort of is an overarching fact that has to color what the Democrats are going to do. But I continue to think the right thing to do, and this is what I said a month ago, is for the investigate and to label it an impeachment inquiry. I would use the word impeachment inquiry, and so that when they're sending subpoenas around to look at things, you know, the president's taxes, things like that, that they've already asked for, you know, instead of saying, well, we're doing this because we're thinking we might need to tinker with the Internal Revenue Code and we want to see how they're handling audits of presidents, I think they should forthrightly say, we're doing this because we're investigating whether to start an impeachment action against the president. We're trying to figure out whether he did a high crime or misdemeanor. So I'd like to see those investigations proceeding directly under the verbiage of impeachment inquiry and openly towards the goal of investigating whether there have been high crimes and misdemeanors. But I don't think it's fruitful to actually get to the point where there's an impeachment trial. I don't see Republican votes in the Senate changing on that. And even if you could change two or three of them, which I think is the maximum possible achievable thing, you know, you'd need to change 19 of them before there's any chance of a removal.
Now, one of the other things that happened this week that caught my attention, Representative Justin Amash, Republican out of Michigan, argued and that, in fact, the president probably has committed acts worthy of impeachment. Now, that in and of itself is not the end of the world, but I was very interested that Cato jumped on board this week and also suggested that, you know what, Representative Amash is correct, pointing to Federalist 65 and kind of taking a more conservative approach, arguing that the president, yeah, maybe he should be impeached. Do you think that there has been a shift of the perception of President Trump on the right? Because it seems to me that there's a possibility, while this may not lead to impeachment, that we might actually begin to be seeing the end of forming the ranks around Donald Trump. What do you think?
Well, I mean, first, you probably have your finger on the pulse beat of the right a little bit more than I do. So you may be better positioned to answer that than me. But I do think there's been a phenomenon of, you know, the whole time Trump's been in office, of certain conservative voices who are not in the Congress. You know, there's been the anti-Trump Republicans the whole time, you know, people like George Will. People like William Kristol, you know, you brought in Cato, even people like Kellyanne Conway's husband, George Conway, have been out there the whole time really saying, you know, that Trump has been committing crimes and in other ways has been unfit for office. So I think that conservatives who don't have to answer to the Republican electorate typically are able to look at these issues more objectively than Republican elected officials who need to maintain, to some extent, the support of voters who voted for Trump and who are perhaps still loyal to Trump. So I think that's a disjunction that I see within the right. Now, Justin Amash is an interesting case because, as you note, you know, he is a Republican elected official, and he may be the first Republican elected official that I can think. Maybe Governor Hogan in Maryland, former Governor Weld in from Massachusetts. You know, a few have been saying similar kinds of things. But I was reading in the papers that when Amash went back to his district in Michigan and held a town meeting and talked about this, and a lot of voters, both Democratic and Republican voters, were there, that he went over very well, that he had a lot more support than opposition from his constituents, which included Republican constituents. So that is interesting. But I actually have to turn the question back to you, because I say you're really more in touch with the I think the voters on the right than I am. What do you think?
Well, you know, that's what I've been kind of wrestling with this week. When Donald Trump first began his run, I took him as a joke, doing it for a publicity stunt. I mean, this was the guy I had grown up watching the, you know, wrestling, and he was the guy who came on wrestling and was kind of a sideshow. And I saw that as being, you know, no more or less than a sideshow. And for the few people who seemed to support Donald Trump early on, they were the bit of the crazies from my point of view. But it seemed that once Donald Trump became president, I was the one who was actually on the ouster when I met and did things with local officials in Florida and now in Oklahoma. You know, they were always quick to have their connection with Trump trumpeted, to make a little bit of a not so funny pun.
Right.
And I think what I see in Amash, and I see in, and I've seen in Cato, but this is the first time I've seen it be so explicit, is a willingness to take a fundamental hit at the president in a way. I mean, you mentioned Conway, but I would say more traditionally conservative outlets. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and not in a quick kind of way. I mean, Amash kind of outlines it in a pretty scholarly manner for what you can do on Twitter. And then, as you mentioned, follows that up later in person with a town hall. And so for me, it kind of feels like maybe we're finally having a moment where everybody's willing to talk a little bit more openly about the president. And I don't know if it's Mueller specifically that makes that happen, but it sure seems like this has at least been the opportunity to give it vent. As you know, in political times, we often see that there has to be some kind of catalyst that allows people to give that voice. And I'm wondering if this hasn't been kind of murmuring a bit under the surface. And so now with this kind of statement, it moves forward. And I agree with you. You made your point earlier that, you know, no one besides the two of us are going to read the full report, right? A buddy of mine who's a sociologist out of Florida, he, you know, he's constantly talking about it. Like, you can even listen to the audiobook version of it. And I'm teasing him about that because I'm like,
right,
guy, nobody's he's a good friend of mine, very good friend of mine, so I don't mean that in a bad way, but he's wrong, right? No one's gonna listen to the audiobook version of the Mueller report. But as a scholar of media, I think that these kinds of very quick sentences that you get from Mueller can be real powerful. And I'm not, in some ways, it might have been him saying less might actually have a bigger impact than had he gone out and taken a bunch of questions.
Yeah, well, actually, yeah. So that's that had me thinking about something, what you just said, because I agree with that. So Mueller, you know, one thing he said at the sort of, you know, at the beginning and end of his brief statement was, you know, there's no point in me testifying in front of Congress. If I do it, I'm not going to say anything that I haven't already written in writing anyhow. You know, I have nothing more to say. Well, I think that's fine. I mean, if I'm Jerry Nadler right now, I'm thinking that's perfect. You know, I'd like to subpoena him, have him come down here and testify, and I'll ask him questions. And if he just simply gives me sound bites where he says things that he already wrote in the Mueller report, and if he doesn't provide one piece of information more than that, that's all I really want, you know, from Nadler's standpoint, right? Just to have the television ready sound clips. It's not really about having him testify to give more information. It's about having him testify to so that he can be on TV saying a sentence or two that he's already written in the Mueller report that nobody read, but now they will see it when it comes on TV. So I think the Democrats have to really, really, really insist that Mueller testify, but they don't have to push him too hard to say anything that isn't in, you know, it's fine if the only things he says verbally are things that he already said in writing, because the key here is just getting it on TV, I think.
Well, in all honesty, I think a very good kind of analogy here is, and it's, in some ways, I saw the Mueller report a little bit like myself when I'm talking about my syllabus, right? So you give your syllabus at the beginning of class, you pass it out, you talk about it, you move it, but nobody reads it, right? No,
right.
By the way, listeners, if you're wondering, nobody reads it, okay? Yeah. it's just true. Take two professors' words for it on this. But then later on, I will inevitably end up having to take a question and saying, well, as it says in the syllabus, you know, the due dates will be Friday at 11. They are, by the way, class, at 11:30, you know, PM. And I do that because that's when everybody's taking their note. That's when everybody's got their recorder on. That's when everybody's actually, you know, writing things down. I felt a little bit like this from the Mueller point of view, because he even mentions, he says, as we talked about in section two, you know, this is why we're not going to do it, but this is also why we don't think we have not cleared the president effectively. It's as if he was attempting to highlight his own syllabus. And so I saw that kind of through a media lens, and I'm hoping that is what is freeing up people on the right to being able to now say, well, look, I've got some issues with Donald Trump, the president Donald Trump as well.
Right. I, you know, and in fact, if Barr hadn't have overplayed his cards, I think Mueller never would have done that. I think Mueller would have been happier to never make a television appearance, but he actually felt compelled to do it because Barr had really, I'm going to go ahead and say lied about. I know people could argue with that, but I think lied about the central finding in the Mueller report, which is, Mueller said on the issue of obstruction, we're not going to clear him. And the only reason we're not going to charge him is because you can't charge the president. And then Barr said, well, what Mueller did was he would have charged him if there was an evidentiary basis, but since there was not enough evidence of guilt, that's why he didn't charge him. So that, I think that's really the opposite of what Mueller said, and I think it aggravated Mueller enough that he felt that he had to get on TV and set the record straight. And now I think that's to Trump's great disadvantage. I think we're both agreeing the fact that Mueller went on television is to Trump's great disadvantage.
I do, and I think that it also opens him up to now maybe having some more serious challenges as a primary, or at least one might hope. And I think that Trump himself is worried, and I think this actually leads into our second story that we want to talk about here, Ken. Okay. And that is that on Thursday, right, so he goes after Mueller after the statement. And he then kind of has this bit of a footnote on Thursday, and he tells reporters on Thursday that he's going to give a quote, big league statement. I'm still not sure if that's what he means by that, or a big league statement, whichever one it is. Later on the day on Friday, dealing with illegal border crossings. And so what we discovered the following day is that, so that happened on Wednesday. So on Thursday, Trump comes out and suggests this week that there are going to be tariffs on all Mexican goods. That's right, all. There's actually no exceptions in this one. And the cause for this is illegal immigration. Now, there wasn't any specifics from the White House on what kind of illegal immigration crackdown is going to be necessary to stop these tariffs. And before we get into the tariffs more specifically, isn't it interesting, though, that this was the card that gets played immediately after Mueller? So before we even talk about the content of the tariffs, Ken, what do you think about the timing of the tariffs?
That's, I had not actually thought about that until you just asked. So I think that's very insightful, because if I understand your implication there, the idea would be Trump is trying to find a way to consolidate his own base. He's worried now that based on Mueller's TV statement, some of his base might actually be wavering about him. And so he's doing something that's really like throwing red meat to his base so that they'll stay loyal to him.
He hints it that day, right? I mean, he could have waited.
Yeah, I think that's a very plausible theory. I had not really thought it through until you just said it, but it makes sense to me.
Well, I'll tell you, the other reason I've been thinking about that is when you think about from a campaign strategy, a communications point of view, you don't drop big news at the end of the week unless you want that news generally to die. So a matter of fact, that was a really powerful position from Reagan, right? He knew when to put the bad news. It was Thursday and Friday, because nobody pays attention to things on Saturday and Sunday in general. I know more recently that kind of has shifted a little bit, but that still holds true. So the first thing I thought about was, this is a weird time of the week to be announcing. But when you saw all of the stories having at the very end of them this, this Trump kind of hinting right after he's talking about the investigation, about his big Lee statement, and then, unveiling it the next day, I couldn't help but see that from the point of view of a political communication scholar. I mean, if I was working on his campaign, this is when I want something to die. So in many ways, I kind of saw this as an attempt to deflate that balloon at least a little bit, or to take up some more oxygen out of the room so that this quote wouldn't get as much traction until you got around to a newer news cycle on Monday.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right, actually. In fact, just to test your theory, while you were talking, I went on to WashingtonPost.com, and I see that three of the top headlines, right? One of the top headlines is Mexico rushes envoy to Washington in bid to prevent Trump's new tariffs plan. One is what Mexico is doing and not doing to keep migrants from crossing into the U.S. One is dozens of Homeland Security agents and investigators to deploy to Guatemala-Mexico border in bid to slow unauthorized migration. So all the top headlines now are about this subject, and that means all the top headlines are no longer about Mueller, right? And that's got to be one of the purposes here.
And if nothing else, Trump has been, I will give him mastery of this, he's been a master of social media, and he's been a master of releasing information.
Yeah. Now, there's, on a substantive level, it's a kind of an irony that here he is still trying to get Congress to approve his revisions to NAFTA, his whatever he called it, the USMCA. And yet, you know, he would be violating it right now, right? Like the very plan that he's saying. You know?
Well, why don't we get down into the details of the policy then, Ken? Because this is a very interesting economic crossover, and this is a big legal question as well. So, listeners, here's the effectives of the plan. We don't know specifically what the benchmarks are, but assuming that Mexico does not crack down on quote illegal immigration. What will begin is that starting on June 10th, all goods shipped from Mexico to the United States are going to face an extra 5% tax. Then on July 1st, that goes up to 10%. On August 1st, it goes up to 15%. On September 1st, it would go up to 20%. And on October 1st, presumably at its highest rate, it would go up to 25%. Now, for those of you who are listening, you might be asking if you have a little bit of knowledge on this. Well, how can the president unilaterally set tariff levels? Isn't that the domain of Congress? Well, he's invoking the International Emergencies Economic Powers Act. Now, I'm going to be honest, I was not familiar with this until I actually read the act itself, read a little bit of the history of the act itself. But this actually gets enacted in 1977 to clarify and restrict, actually, interestingly, presidential power during times of declared national emergency. This is coming kind of in the wake of thinking a little bit about a case that you and I talked earlier in the year about, Ken, the Youngstown Sheet Tube Company.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so this was an attempt to kind of limit the power during emergency declarations. But this is the act that's being used by the president to kind of bypass Congress. So I almost feel like we're having the same show again, only this time, instead of talking about building a wall, we're talking about enacting tariffs. So Ken, what do you think about the use of this act? Let's start there in using tariffs. And just to put this in context, it's interesting that Chuck Grassley of Iowa has already argued that this is an abuse of the act. So do you agree with Grassley? Do you disagree? How does this act fit in to tariffs?
Well, yeah, I mean, of course I agree with Grassley because I don't believe there's an emergency, right? But if you, the harder question would be if you believe there is an emergency. But
yes.
I think. So I think anyone who doesn't believe that what's happening at the border is an emergency.
And I think we've kind of already talked that one. I mean, if you'd like to hear more about this. What 3 months ago now we had that conversation. No, 2 months, I guess, right. It would have been. Continue, right. Ken. Yeah.
So I mean, for there to even be a debatable point here, there'd have to be, some notion that this is an emergency. But this, you know, this statute, if you think of the sort of intended uses of it, so when the Iranians took the hostages in the 1970s, shortly after the act was enacted, President Carter froze all the Iranian assets that were in the United States. So the Iranians had bank accounts and brokerage accounts and real estate here. And the government used this statute to declare that the hostage taking was an international emergency and that they weren't going to unfreeze these assets until it was resolved. That's the kind of thing that the statute is intended for. That's something where the hostages, when the hostages were taken, you know, Congress had not already specifically legislated on how to deal with that. So the International Economic Emergency Powers Act gives the framework, the president some latitude to deal with that. But in the case of what's happening at the border, you know, the president has gone to Congress, has said what he wants them to do, and they've refused it. So that's a totally different kind of framework. Under Youngstown Steel, the idea is that the president has some additional powers to deal with emergencies if he deals with them in ways that is consistent with how Congress would have wanted them dealt with. Youngstown certainly says that the president can't do things just to, to ignore the will of Congress. And in Youngstown, President Truman's seizure of the steel mills is declared unconstitutional, as it should have been, because it went directly against the will of Congress. So I don't personally think, in what I would consider the absence of any real emergency, that there's any basis for using this. But
I have a specific question on that, Ken, given the context of what I have looked at in the law, it seems like a tariff would never be an appropriate mechanism in the context of what's being happened here, because that seems like what seems to be happening from the White House is suggesting, well, we get to take this power from Congress if there's emergency, where really what it seems like the law is about is granting powers to presidents that neither Congress or the president would generally have outside of the act of an emergency. What do you think about that as a reading?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the idea of the International Emergency Economic Powers Act and some similar statutes like the National Emergencies Act is that there will occasionally be bona fide emergencies that somebody needs to deal with quickly and rapidly in real time. And so Congress has written a little bit of the blank check to presidents to be able to do that. But it really does depend on the idea that the presidents are acting in good faith, that the emergencies are bona fide, that these are things that come up all of a sudden.
But could a tariff ever be an emergency reaction? I mean, this is a graduated tariff over the course of months.
Oh, I see.
It doesn't appear that even the nature of the action would qualify as an emergency action, right? It just seems like you're just wholesale reaching over into the pocket of Congress and saying, well, I want this to happen. It's mine now.
Yeah. Let me actually, I'll very slightly defend Trump on that part
okay.
of the point.
Please do.
So even though I think, as I said, there's no emergency here and there's no predicate for using this, I think that if there was a bona fide emergency, then the statute is intended to give some flexibility to the president about what kinds of economic sanctions he uses in response to a bona fide emergency. So let's go back to the Iranian hostage crisis as an example. Let's suppose that hostages were taken, and instead of freezing all the assets, which is what President Carter did, let's say he would have said, okay, I'm going to impose big tariffs against Iran now, say on Iranian oil, until they release the hostages. I think that's probably okay under the statute that the idea of the statute seems to me to say, the president can unilaterally use economic sanctions if he needs to resolve a fast developing bona fide emergency that before Congress has time to really deliberate and figure out how to deal with it. If somebody needs to take action right now, the president can figure out what kind of action is appropriate as long as it's within the realm of economic action. So I think that isn't the fact that it's a tariff. The thing that I thought, the place I thought you were going with that, which I would have agreed with more, is the tariff statutes themselves, you know, NAFTA, GATT, WTO, all these trade agreements, they provide for possible imposition of tariffs sometimes, but only in response to unfair trade practices by the trading partner. And this supposed migrant crisis is not a trading practice. Mm-hmm. So it seems very inapposite, right? That you know, if we thought, for instance, that those countries were somehow preventing our companies from competing fairly in their markets, then we might have justification under the trade agreements to impose tariffs. But those kinds of justifications, which contemplate that the U.S. might impose tariffs as a means of sanctions, that's entirely related to trade disputes, and this is not a trade dispute. So he's kind of mixing and matching. He's using a tool that's really a tool that is intended to be used in trade disputes, and he's using it in a kind of unprecedented way to in something that's not a trade dispute, but a different kind of dispute, and that I would go farther and say isn't even a real emergency. So I think to me, those are the main problems.
So with our first two stories being about Trump-related issues, and I think that oftentimes is the case, Ken, we always seem to get the weeks when that is on the fore. I think we have two additional stories we want to take on that maybe they're indirectly related to the president, but only a little bit so. And I think the first of them that we're going to take a look at is abortion. And as a matter of fact, I think in some ways we might even think of this as being the spring of rekindling the abortion debate. And that gets capped this week on Thursday when Louisiana Governor Edwards, a Democrat, signs into law a bill banning abortion after a fetal heartbeat it can be detected. Now, we got to be careful here because even that term, a fetal heartbeat, is a debatable one because at that point, fetuses do not have hearts in the way that Ken and I do. And so this leads to a lot of, I think, what we're going to be talking about. The ban has no exceptions for rape. It doesn't have exceptions for incest. And it would effectively make abortions as early as 6 weeks illegal. Now, what's interesting about the Louisiana bill is it's only going to go into effect if the Mississippi law, which is very similar to this one, which is now in court, is upheld. Mississippi's and Louisiana's joins Kentucky, Ohio, and Georgia of this year. None of these laws have yet gone into effect, while some of them have already been challenged in court, like Mississippi's. And I think one of the things that's worth kind of talking about here is, of course, we can talk about abortion as a policy itself, or abortion bans, or women's choice as being a policy point. It's also an interesting political point because Louisiana highlights, I think, two things about this debate that have been overlooked. One of those is that state Democrats both support and sponsor these kinds of bills. And I don't think that's something that we've talked about probably at the national level enough. And secondly, that it's white women from both parties that have actually pushed and been a big part of what's made these abortion bans in larger normal numbers than has been normally realized. So all of these cases are really designed to send bills to the Supreme Court, and it really has brought back the question of women's rights versus babies and fetuses. So Ken, I guess I'm going to start with here is one of the things that's interesting about Louisiana, and I know you want to talk a little bit about Illinois, is do you think at a local level, because there's been so much conversation about national level issues, that some of the infighting between parties on this issue has gone overlooked, and that there has been maybe an assumption that there has been more widespread negativity from women on this, given that they're a big part of a reason, at least I want to say white women, on this issue as well? Are we missing some of the nuance here? Is that part of the reason why this might seemingly be a surprise?
I feel like the divides in the country may be more geographic than partisan to some extent, although obviously geography correlates with partisanship. Because in the North, you'd have a lot of pro-choice Republicans, and then in the South, as you're pointing out, you have pro-life Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
So that, yeah, on that point, I don't know that I see the internal division as being any more an issue for Democrats than for Republicans. I think that both parties in different parts of the country might have different kinds of internal divisions that way.
I actually don't disagree with you on that at all. I agree. Continue.
Yeah. But of course, there's a geographic. Partisanship is related to geography because the whole Bible Belt is basically Republican, and New England at this point doesn't have even a single Republican in Congress. So the geography and the partisanship correlate a little bit. The way I was thinking about these new abortion laws is I was seeing it more as a little bit of a disjunction between the Republican partisan politics and actually the pro-life movement, because I think if your goal is to raise money from Republican donors, then these kind of very aggressive kinds of stances, we're going to pass a bill with no rape exception, no incest exception, we're going to take it to the Supreme Court, that's really good for raising money on. It's really good for getting bases energized. And it seems to me like that's the point here, because if the point conversely was just to minimize the number of abortions in the country, but to do it in a less divisive way. I think that these kind of bans don't advance that, because what they end up doing is actually interrupting a process where the Republican controlled Supreme Court for nearly 30 years now, has been simultaneously saying, well, we're going to adhere to Roe and we're not going to overrule it, but on the other hand, every single restriction on abortion that we ever see, we're going to sustain and we're not going to strike down, right? And so if the goal is to put more and more restrictions on abortion, then the way to do that is to just put more and more restrictions on abortion, but never quite try to get Roe overruled. And all those restrictions, I think the court was ready to sustain, and that would include people like Roberts and Kavanaugh. Whereas if you're if we're going to do go all the way to the way Alabama's gone now, then you risk actually going so far that a Roberts or a Kavanaugh could rule against you. And meanwhile, you're going to get a backlash from states like Illinois, which are, you know, which I did want to talk about, which is, you know, which never would have passed the law that it passed in, last week unless Alabama had passed the law that it passed last week. And you know, in Illinois, sort of as a counter reaction to what's going on in Alabama, they basically repealed almost all the remaining abortion laws, including bans on partial birth abortion, bans on late term abortion, things like that. And so the sort of net effect of, you know, how many more abortions are you going to have in Illinois now? Versus how many fewer are you going to have in Alabama? I'm going to venture a guess that the net cumulative effect of all this divisive controversy is going to be both to increase the number of abortions in the country and to also increase the chance of an adverse ruling for the pro-life movement at the Supreme Court. So I don't think the pro-life movement is actually being served by any of this. And I think even Pat Robertson said so in a way. But I think some Republican politicians are serving themselves by all of this.
So if we take that view that it's really about kind of energizing the base, if it's the goal is to raise money, then why the Louisiana? Why the bipartisan nature of that in Louisiana? Because it doesn't seem to me that pro-life Democrats don't get much love, if you will, from the pro-life movement. So what's the impetus there in that schema then, you think, Ken?
Yeah, so I take it that they're just backed into corners by the Republicans, right? So that if you're in a state like Louisiana, where you've got an electorate that's going to be responsive to that kind of pro-life messaging, and the Republicans start pushing this stuff, you know, for their own partisan reasons, I think some of those Democrats make the judgment, you know, if you can't beat them, join them. But I think that's the explanation of why the Democrats are on board in those states. I don't see that the Democrats are really being the ringleaders on any of this stuff in those states, but I think sometimes they're just concluding that, you know, you got to choose your battles, and or maybe they actually, you know, forced to vote on this. Maybe they sincerely think, well, although I'd rather not take a vote on a bill like this, if I have to take a vote on a bill like this, you know, I am pro-life, so I'm going to have to vote that way. So I don't think there is any political benefit in this for the Democrats, but I think some of the Democrats might pay a higher political cost in those states if they didn't go along with it.
Well, it was one of the reason I kind of asked that question is Milkovich, the state senator, is a Democrat who's the one who proposed the Louisiana ban. And that actually took me a little bit aback. I would not have suspected that he would have put it out there. My initial reaction would be to think kind of what you had said, Ken, to say, well, backed into a corner. This is, in fact, what I believe. I'd rather not have to take a vote on it. But if we are, this is what I believe. So I'm going to vote. So when I saw that it's actually a Democrat who had been the sponsor for the bill, that made me kind of question that potential position. And I was having trouble myself trying to answer that. And where I have, and again, maybe this makes us sound a little similar, maybe a little different, I don't know, is that could this in part be a little bit more of that that regional identity playing itself out? It does appear to me that as we've had every time you kind of start gearing up for presidential races, in some ways, I think there is a little bit of a backlash in saying, well, you know, localities matter more. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, so I think that's right. I mean, it may be the case that in certain of these southern states, there's enough single issue voters, right? There's enough voters who just will not vote for someone who's pro-choice. They're only going to vote for someone who's pro-life. And maybe they may be inclined to the view that the Republicans are more reliably the party that they side with on that issue. Then that may really require in some jurisdictions, in some localities, that a Democratic politician who wants to be viable has to really grab that issue by the horns and just, you know, put themselves out there as, look, if you agree with me on other issues, if you're for, you know, healthcare or something like that, then, you know, don't worry about the abortion issue because I'm going to vote the same way as a Republican is. I think that might just be a survival strategy in some places. And also, as we both agreed, it may be sincere also, right? I mean, there may be people, it may just be that values in some localities, people have values in Louisiana that are different than the values that people have in Illinois, and they are voting their values. So it's so I think all those things are possible.
Well, I think we'll probably be talking about this one more as the Supreme Court continues to rule on it. You know, we've already had an unsigned opinion come out for Indiana for a couple of years, just now coming out, of course. But I think as these come up and they come out, we'll probably have some more things to talk about. And I hope we get to take them on, Ken, given that it's court issues.
Yeah. In fact, the one thing I want to say about that is just I think the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court there were actually two different abortion restrictions at issue in the Seventh Circuit case out of Indiana, and they the Seventh Circuit had basically struck down both measures, and the Supreme Court reversed one and not the other. So they
allowed for having the burial processes.
The burial process, right? I think the very fact that the Supreme Court looked at two restrictions that a lower court had struck down and said, well, we're going to reinstate one of those restrictions. We're going to overrule that lower court, but we're not going to reinstate both of those restrictions. We're going to sustain the lower court on one. I think they're really signaling that they are not, you know, as gung-ho about a straight-up overruling of Roe as some people seem to think they are, because if they were, they would have happily overruled both of the restrictions at issue in the Seventh Circuit case. It seems to me that's a kind of a signaling that they'd like to slow things down a little bit.
Well, especially since they leave it unsigned, which means that you don't know the way in which anyone voted.
Right, right. Although actually you know, I think you do really. I mean, informally you don't, but it only takes 4 votes for the Supreme Court to actually have to take up one of these issues. So I think if they couldn't even get 4 votes, then I would think I'd be pretty confident to say that it was both Roberts and Kavanaugh who decided to leave the other restriction in place, other Seventh Circuit holding in place.
I hear it. In other words,
so two of the Republicans had to cross the aisle on that one, otherwise they would have taken up both issues.
I hear you. Yeah. Well, for our final, as we start to run out of time, for our final issue this week, listeners, we want to talk a little bit about the DNC debate thresholds. And this is one that I am interested in personally, because it's really about thinking about the role of political parties in the contemporary scene, which has shifted significantly over time. But this week, the DNC has argued for stricter new requirements for presidential contenders to appear in party debates. Now, why is this a big deal? Well, the first party debates, which are coming up this summer, are going to require either 65,000 donors or for candidates to secure 1% in 3 qualified polls. However, if you want to come in to the fall debate, they've actually upped the ante. You're now going to have 130,000 unique donors or 2% in 4 qualified polls. Many are criticizing the move, including former Representative Delaney, who said, quote, the DNC is playing a gatekeeper function, and they're creating a filter to determine which candidates can make their arguments to the American people, end quote. But here's my question, Ken. Shouldn't that be exactly what political parties do? I know that since the era of the progressives, there's been a shift on this, and we can talk about that, especially as you get to the 1968 convention with Humphrey's convention and Nixon's convention, launching us towards a more popularly elected primary system. But what is the role of political parties in this process? I mean, are we getting to the point where they're just meaningless, or do they still have a role here? Because if you agree with Delaney, it seems to me, if they aren't supposed to play any kind of gatekeeper function, well, then they're really not playing any function whatsoever. So am I wrong? What do you think, Ken?
No, I'm with you on this. I'm glad that they're going to have these thresholds. You know, I also like the superdelegate system, which I think that's an analogous issue where,
you should write in about this. We have some questions. If you're interested in this topic, we're going to be taking on some of those questions on the Wednesday. We're going to have an Ask the Politics Guys, Ken and Trey show. So you should join us on Wednesday because we're going to talk more about superdelegates, because we got a question about superdelegates this week. But continue, Ken, talking out.
I didn't even know that, but I only raised it because I knew we had a question, but because I think the idea here is these are ways that the parties try to have some control over who gets their nominations. And I think that's perfectly appropriate. I mean, for parties to exist, it depends on people who are willing to put in the work to actually do the party work. And so those people, I think, justifiably, have both more knowledge and maybe, more judgment and should have more influence because they're doing the work of actually party building and that kind of thing. And second of all, it's bewildering for the voters to have. You can have a debate with 25 people on stage. I mean, I can't even see any value. Like, even if the idea was, some voter wants the idea to wants to get a really unfiltered view of all the candidates. You know, it's too unwieldy. You wouldn't get an unfiltered view of all the candidates if you had 25 candidates up there. You'd just hear from each of them for a minute or two. And who knows, whether that would be, something that would be very substantive or not. So I think it's good for parties. I actually think if the Republicans would have had a stronger, if they would have had superdelegates and if they would have had this kind of gatekeeping, they never would have got Trump as the nominee. And I think that's a good thing. I really don't like the idea of what might be seen as populist insurgency, but also what I would see as replacing the influence of parties with the influence of big money that's outside the parties. I think parties have more legitimacy than the sources of big money, which seems to me that that's what would fill the vacuum if the parties got weakened.
No, what's interesting to me, and I feel like sometimes I'm a bit of a voice in the wilderness, or maybe just an Adams on this one. Pick either one, But I think that a lot of the moves of the progressives in the late 19th century continue in the 1960s. To try to get rid of the smoke-filled rooms, while they were laudable in intent, they actually led to a lot of the contemporary political tumors and problems that we see. I mean, again, go back to the 1968 convention. That's where we're going to get this push towards the idea that we don't want parties. It's kind of the capper to not wanting parties to play any kind of gatekeeper function, because we want the average person to decide. And my answer is the average person can't decide. It doesn't make sense to try to have them decide. As you're saying, out of 27,000 candidates, it's not going to happen. And it's not coincidental, in my opinion, as a scholar of political communication, to say it's the 1968 convention that gives us the beginning of the ideas of talking heads coming out of ABC. It's where we get pundits. It's where we get the famous left-right debates that give us the rise to cable and to the social media soundtrack. And I don't think any of that has done the political process much good, and the problem it was attempting to fix was not as bad as the cure. Maybe I'm a little stronger on this than you are, Ken. I don't know. What do you think?
I agree. I mean, we didn't get Abraham Lincoln or Franklin Roosevelt through a primary process, and I don't know. I don't know that the primary. I don't really know that it does what it's supposed to do, and I think it's good to have them. But I think the more mediated versions of the primaries, I mean, you do want to use primaries to some extent to make sure that you're not picking somebody who's unacceptable to voters, right? So primaries do some vetting. Somebody's got to be able to get votes in a primary, or else they're probably not going to be able to get votes in a general election. But
that's different than TV ratings, which is effectively what you're basically saying is, well, who can ever get the most media coverage is the one who ought to win.
Yeah. Now, one thing I like about the way things have been done historically in both parties is I like the idea of starting with New Hampshire and Iowa, because I think the small state, starting in small states where the politicians can do retail campaigning and don't have to rely on money as much at first, I think levels the playing field at first, right? So that the candidates all have the same opportunity to get out there in states like Iowa and New Hampshire and try to persuade voters. And so you start to have a situation where, the input that you're getting in those states from primary voters is very useful. But on the other hand, I wouldn't, I don't like the idea of just, dispensing with a party infrastructure entirely. And I'm fully in support of what the DNC is doing here.
No, it's interesting to me that this continues to be the big push. But I think we're going to actually have to leave the show here, Ken, because we've already gone long. So I hope, listeners, that you've enjoyed this week's Politics Guys. But I want to remind everybody before we head out that Michael Baranowski is actually currently teaching a dystopian politics and film course. And every week he's going to be posting commentary on that week's film for all of our Patreon supporters on our Patreon site, patreon.com/politicsguys. Last week he talked about, and this was actually really interesting, Planet of the Apes and Escape from New York. This week's upcoming movies are Blade Runner and RoboCop. So if you're interested in the dystopian politics of film and you'd like to get on this, any kind of Patreon supporter that you are will get you to this level. All you have to do is be a supporter of the Politics Guys by heading to politicsguys.com/support and clicking there for either PayPal or for Patreon. And that will hook you up with this week's Blade Runner and RoboCop. Of course, also last week's things on Planet of the Apes and Escape from New York. Well, with that being said, I want to thank you all for joining us on the Politics Guys. The executive producers of the Politics Guys are Michael Baranowski, Jay Carson, Bruce Johnson, Wilmer Morano, Benji Fishman. Today's show was produced by myself, Trey Orndorff. We'll be back with a new show on Wednesday. I hope you'll join us then.